From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll explore whether the Milwaukee area has strategies in place in the event of historic flooding.
Certainly, river restoration projects can make a big difference, particularly if you can move houses and other buildings outside of that floodplain. That can be really, really valuable. And so every little bit helps.
Later, our How Did You Do That feature details the remarkable transformation of Kyle Weatherly from law student to Habitat for Humanity volunteer to business leader.
And the somewhat obscure story of a famous philosopher's one night in Milwaukee.
Henry David Thoreau seldom ventured outside of New England. So the second location that he chose to go outside of New England included Milwaukee.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Parts of Wisconsin experienced torrential rains over the past week, with historic amounts falling from the sky.
Roads flooded or in some cases were washed out in Dane and Iowa counties. Some state trails have closed until further notice.
But WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz turned her attention closer to home. She wondered, where does Milwaukee stand in the ability to cope with massive rainstorms?
Patrick Elliott with the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, MMSD, stands above the Kinnickinnick River in Pulaski Park on the city's south side. It's one of three rivers within Milwaukee's massive watershed that feed into Lake Michigan. The MMSD project manager says the Kinnickinnick is the most densely developed.
We needed more space for those flood flows to pass through rather than having those flood flows rise up and pour into the neighborhood.
In the 1960s, Milwaukee joined many cities in what was considered cutting-edge stormwater management technology, lining rivers with concrete. Turns out the measure reduced control rather than improving it.
The concrete lining, it was designed to move water quickly, and really impressive when it's flying through here because it's a raging river. And the unfortunate part is that it gets slippery, and if you slip and fall in, there's little hope that you're going
to
get out.
There's also no chance for excess water to be absorbed into the ground. Elliott says soon crews will naturalize the KK along Pulaski Park and then fill in with projects up and downstream.
It's part of a much larger plan that we have within the Kinnickinnick River watershed. Between 16th all the way down to the south end of the park, we're going to be removing the concrete lining and then replacing that with rocks and natural vegetation on the side and having that blend into the park area.
Crews will even relocate the existing playground and basketball court to allow the natural floodplain to do what Mother Nature intended, absorb water when the river swells. This work is not new to MMSD. Over the years, it has removed homes and naturalized flood-prone areas throughout the region. Elliott says green infrastructure also factors into MMSD's flood management strategy. So far, the agency has permanently conserved more than 3,500 acres in Milwaukee, as well as Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties.
Green Seams is really looking at the future and making sure that those properties that are really critical to absorbing water and storing water in these upstream areas, making sure that that doesn't get developed and create additional flooding concerns in the downstream sections of the watershed.
Elliott believes MMSD's flood prevention efforts are paying off. He says Milwaukee is better equipped to reduce the risk of flooding.
It is a challenge. We're seeing more frequent flood events, and they're stronger and more intense. But we're completing projects like these, and it's only going to make us more resilient to handle those floodwaters.
But Milwaukee's Environmental Sustainability Director, Eric Schamberger, can't promise the city will be able to prevent flooding. His team is tasked with coming up with strategies to make Milwaukee more resilient.
If 10 inches falls on the city of Milwaukee and in 24 hours like it did in Madison, we're going to be in trouble no matter what, I think. But for a lot of the bigger storms that are coming, this will certainly help reduce the risk of basement backups and flooding. And then when it's not raining, create a much better, more pleasant, more calming urban environment.
The environment he's standing on is Fondy Park, next to Fondy Market on the city's north side. What was until recently a blighted city block not only collects 71,000 gallons of stormwater.
We're pulling stormwater from the streets as well as the roofs of the farmers market itself, and then we're developing plans to pull even more water from this main roof here.
When it's not raining, on days like this, families with young children are enjoying its green space, interspersed by young trees and native plants. This is one of six city stormwater management projects in a six-block area. And these aren't isolated projects. Milwaukee's Department of Public Works started incorporating green infrastructure back in 2008. In 2013, Schamberger says the program was formalized.
So that every time a street is reconstructed, we're systematically evaluating it to put in green infrastructure.
Schamberger says next month the Common Council will take up a proposed ordinance meant to inspire more businesses to take up the green infrastructure mantle.
Under current law, when properties disturb more than an acre of land, you know, the big developments, they have to do a stormwater management plan. And we're looking at changes so that when they do that plan, we want them to capture the first half inch of rain on the site through green infrastructure.
Fondy Park, the city project Schamberger just showed me, captures at least an inch of rain. Cheryl Nunn with Milwaukee Riverkeeper says other cities are stepping up. Why not raise the bar for all of Milwaukee?
Philadelphia, they have a goal to capture the first inch of rain that falls on the city. In Chicago, if you build a new building, you're required to put a green roof on it. The problem in the Milwaukee area has always been that there's hesitancy there to go too far on the regulation front because you could be scaring businesses away to the suburbs. But I think we could push it a little further, requiring more green infrastructure, certainly for new development and also for redevelopment where possible.
Nunn believes Milwaukee needs to both aggressively ramp up green infrastructure and tend to failing infrastructure underground.
I mean, clean rainwater that's getting into our sanitary pipes through cracked pipes, through foundation drains in some cases, through cracked and maybe not well-sealed manhole covers, things like that. That's a problem in that it fills up the capacity of the sanitary sewer, and when you have these really intense storms, you know, it contributes to sewage overflows.
It can result in water quality and public health issues. Researcher Daniel Wright studies hydroclimate extremes at UW-Madison and does not sugarcoat the likelihood that Milwaukee will be hit by future flood-caliber rainstorms.
If you look at Milwaukee compared to the areas north, south, and west of Milwaukee, there's a much higher propensity for heavy thunderstorms right over the city than there is in the surrounding areas.
Wright describes Milwaukee's densely paved surfaces as an urban heat island.
Urban areas, pavement and whatnot, can absorb and retain a lot of heat from the sun. That urban heat island can actually influence the rainfall patterns as well. And so it appears that in the Milwaukee area, there's an interesting interaction between the urban heat island effect and the lake right there that's causing storms to form over Milwaukee, and then those storms actually pull up evaporated water from the nearby lake surface, and so basically the lake is helping to feed these storms as they develop.
And Wright says the time of year floods historically occurred is shifting. 50 years ago, they tended to happen in the spring.
By a combination of springtime storms, dropping rain on whatever snow might have been on the ground in the spring, and you get a flood through that combination of rainfall and snowmelt. And then now, these big, short-lived summertime thunderstorms that seem to be popping up over the city more than in the surrounding areas. And so, basically, not only are the floods getting worse as we develop our urban areas more, but also the timing of year in which they happen is changing.
So what's Wright's take? Is Milwaukee in a better position to handle potential flooding?
Certainly river restoration projects can make a big difference, particularly if you can move houses and other buildings outside of that floodplain, that can be really, really valuable. And so every little bit helps. It's still an open question when you're talking about really big storms, how much of a difference you can make.
Susan Bentz, 89.7, WUWM.
You can read more about flood preparedness at WUWM.com.
How did a Wisconsin man go from law school to Habitat for Humanity to running a company that made supplies for people with edema? Our monthly How Did You Do That feature is next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is Executive Director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keene.
Tim is Founder and Director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That?, a show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
Kyle Weatherly took over his mother's compression garment business in 2006, grew it 30% a year, and sold it 10 years later, all without a relevant degree, and in fact, he started out wanting to be a lawyer. After he sold Solaris in 2014, Kyle and his new wife spent a year staying in Airbnbs around the world, a trip that inspired Kyle's next business.
Kyle, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks for having me.
Your mom was an occupational therapist who founded Solaris as a company that made compression garments, quilted blankets that fit people's anatomy if they have lymphedema, a condition in which fluid retention causes swelling. But after college, when you decided not to be a lawyer, weren't you working for Habitat for Humanity?
Yeah, it was an evolution. It wasn't just one day that I decided not to be a lawyer. I finished up undergrad, and I thought the fastest path towards prestige and a six-figure income was to be a lawyer. But I wanted to take a year off. I was inspired by a couple of things. My university, University of Wisconsin-Madison, talks a lot about the Peace Corps. That seemed a little too long. 2 years was a bit too much. So taking a year off to go work for Habitat for Humanity felt right to me. In addition, I was a part of the AmeriCorps program. My dad was a part of the AmeriCorps program 30 years prior. It was then, once I actually got to South Central LA, that the evolution of not really wanting to become a lawyer anymore happened over time. And while I worked at Habitat for Humanity, at that time I decided I wanted to become a nonprofit leader. So from there, through a combination of a fellowship at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Habitat for Humanity, they covered my tuition to get my master's in nonprofit management.
So Kyle, if you were running a Habitat for Humanity group, do you have a construction background, and wouldn't you need that?
I don't have a construction background at all, and judging by the fact they hired me, maybe it was a mistake, but apparently you don't need it to go to work as an AmeriCorps volunteer.
But Kyle, how did you learn all the things you needed to know on a construction job site?
Half of it, I would say, is they put you in the deep end. The first day, they give you a hammer, they give you a saw, and you need to figure it out. The other half was I went to the Long Beach Public Library almost every night for the first 6 months, and I checked out every book. This is before the days of the internet where you could just Google, you know, how to run 12-volt wiring in a house. You actually had to go to the library, read the book, and absorb it. So I spent the first 10 hours of most days on the construction site trying to figure out how to use that hammer they gave me, and then I spent the next 4 or 5 hours at the library reading books on how I should actually do that properly.
So Kyle, how did you wind up at Solaris from a construction job after you decided you didn't want to be an attorney?
Well, first I went to grad school thinking I was going to go run a Habitat for Humanity somewhere in the world. So I went and got my degree in nonprofit management. I was fortunate enough to finish up a semester early and was looking around saying, what do I want to do? I had a fellowship, so I could have stayed and take one class and enjoyed 4 months. But at the same time, my mom, who I've been, you know, she's my mom, I talk to on a pretty regular basis, had become frustrated with managing her six-person company that she had started 10 years ago. To hear my mom tell the story, she will say that I begged her to give me a job. To hear me tell the story, you will hear me say that she begged me to come work for her. The truth is probably somewhere in between.
But my thinking at the time is I'd go to work for my mom's six-person company for 2 years, and it would round out my resume, and I could go then run a Habitat for Humanity somewhere in the world, yet to be determined. The thing that was really surprising in there is within 6 months, I fell in love with working in a small business. The same impact I was seeking in Habitat for Humanity, I found actually in a small business. I found that the same fulfillment that I got from building homes for people that don't have the means to otherwise afford a home, I got from trying to build better products, trying to treat our coworkers well, trying to treat our suppliers well. It was very surprising to me.
What was the job you started out doing at Solaris?
So I was originally the vice president of operations, but it was a six-person company, which means titles really didn't matter. I mean, some days I handled the shipping. Some days I answered the phone. Some days I sewed. I had one of the great benefits I had was I joined the company when we were so small that I had to learn everything. Part of it was mentality, but part of it was out of necessity. We just needed to get products shipped, phone calls answered.
Kyle, you said you learned plumbing and electricity by reading books at the library. How did you learn to sew?
There is a woman named Kim Dung, who is our first sewer at Solaris. And she does not speak any English, but she was incredibly patient with me and taught me how to I think she was cursing at me in Vietnamese the whole time, but she was very gracious with me, and it took several weeks before I became even partially competent. But turns out to this day, I can still sew pretty well.
So let me go back to something here. There seems to be a lot of on-the-job learning here. And for a lot of people, that sounds pretty scary. How do you cope with that whole idea of stepping into a situation and figuring out what to do next?
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from. I think it's just a mentality, but I view it the exact opposite way. Like, that's the part that's interesting to me. So when I look at opportunities, whatever it is, whether it's being part of an organization, being part of a board, starting a new company, the part that's intriguing to me, it's not scary at all, but the part that is actually draws me to it is the ability to learn all these new things.
Even sewing.
So you went from vice president of operations to the CEO over some period of time. How did that happen?
It wasn't one of those things that happened overnight. Eventually, I think within a couple of years, I decided I wanted to make this my life's work. At the same time, my mom got comfortable with the idea of me taking it over. So it was a gradual transition. I'm sure there's one day that I officially changed the bottom of my email from vice president to president. But in reality, it was a gradual thing. The more I learned, the more responsibility I took on. And eventually, I just had a lot more responsibility than anyone else in the company.
So this company grew at 30% a year for 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a really big deal. How did you manage to pull that off?
First, I think there was some luck. My mom entered the field of lymphedema and the treatment of people with edema disease or swelling disorders because she was passionate about it, because her mom had lymphedema. What none of us knew was the market was going to explode in terms of size. Lymphedema is a condition often caused post-cancer, and over the course of just my tenure, the average cancer survivability rate doubled. So rather than having patients for 4 years on average, we had patients on average for 8 years. So this is one of these situations where everyone wins. Patients are living longer, but for us as a company, our market doubled in size just because these are durable goods that last approximately a year. So that's number one. The other thing is, I wish I could point to one thing. For me, it was showing up every day trying to make the company better. In some days, it was, how do we make our customer service better? How do we make our sales better? Why aren't we having success selling in Texas? Let's dig into that today. Or let's dig into that for this week. Or let's dig into that for the next year and hire a sales rep to really focus on Texas. It's focusing on one small problem at a time and tackling them. From my experience, what I saw is the adage about, you know, how do you eat an elephant? Well, one bite at a time. that's how we built Solaris, and that's how we achieved that level of growth.
So you were selling these garments to cancer patients. Were there others, maybe professional athletes, trainers?
Yeah, we thought that it was an opportunity for a year or two, and we pursued it. We did a lot of cool things. We went to the NFL Combine. We went to the equivalent of the NFL Combine for the MBA. But it took us a year or two to realize that that was, let's call it the shiny object we were chasing. It's cool. It's athletic. It's orthopedics. It's a huge market. There's all these sexy reasons to look at that market. It took about a year or two before we had the discipline to say the market we're in right now is a significantly better market for growth for us, that we really need to go back to sticking to our knitting and focus on lymphedema. And if we're going to look at expansion, let's look at ancillary markets and very closely related markets. So we started originally serving the lymphedema market. When we moved, we first moved to orthopedics, which was a huge mistake. And it took us a while to realize it. But the next time that we pivoted into another market, it was a closely related market, which is venous disease.
Which is what?
Venous disease, which causes varicose veins or many times worse.
So you realized that Solaris needed to focus on its core markets, but then you figured out something else. You figured out your customers were buying only about 1% of their products from you. So what did you do about that?
Yeah, so we use these specialized products to develop a market channel. And we sold in every state in 40 different countries. But as you said, we realized out of all the money that they were spending to fill their store with products and serve their customers, we were probably 1% of their total spend. So we made the obvious deduction. How do we get that to 2%? How do we get that to 3%? How do we get that to 4%? And the answer for us was to introduce even more products that were closely related. So we looked at the products that our customers were already selling. We did research into which ones they were unhappy with, which ones they thought there was room for improvement. And then we started introducing products that our customers already sold.
So you bought a minority stake in Solaris from your parents in 2009 and the rest of the company in 2011? So by the time it was acquired, you were fully in control.
Correct.
And you'd grown the company from 5 to 130 employees?
That's correct.
So how did you decide to sell it, and why did you do that?
Well, I didn't want to sell it, to be honest. There was actually no point where we did decide. What happened, and this is pure serendipity, is another competitor company of ours, they sold to a very large German company. And within a couple months, three other large German companies that were peers of that first German company called us and decided that they wanted to buy us. And at that point, we still didn't want to sell. But it got to a point where it made my parents more than financially secure for the rest of their lives. And for a son who was given an opportunity at the age of 26 to run a company, to be able to repay that and make sure that they never have to worry about money again, that is a very hard thing to say no to. And in fact, judging by my actions, I wasn't able to say no to that.
You used an auction process to sell this company. Can you tell us and our listeners about how that worked and what you learned from that?
Yeah, it happened to us by happenstance. And we were very fortunate to have several strategic bidders on this. But we were able to mandate things. I mean, price is the big one. But you can mandate any number of things that are important to you. So for us, it was very important to us that the company stay in Milwaukee. And these are foreign-owned companies. Many of them had headquarters in other places of the United States. And I had nightmares about driving down I-94, having just exited a company, being financially secure for life, but seeing a vacant building that we used to work at, knowing that the people that helped build that company, that helped get me to where I was, no longer had jobs there. I mean, I really lived in fear of that. I had visions of driving down I-94 and a vacant building. So once you have a number of potential acquirers, you're able to drive price, but you're also able to drive whatever your preference is. So for us, our key preference was mandating that they stay in Milwaukee. And it went so far as mandating that they move their North American headquarters to Milwaukee.
And you were able to pull that off because you have competitive bidders.
Correct.
You stayed with Lohman and Rauscher for 15 months. Then you traveled around the world with your wife. Tell us how you made the decision about the new venture you started when you got back.
Yeah, so me and my wife spent about a year overseas, almost every continent. We stayed at Airbnbs. We like Airbnbs for a number of reasons. You can stay in neighborhoods rather than staying in the hotel district. You have a little bit more space. Turns out spending 2 months at a time with only one other person, it doesn't hurt to have two separate rooms at times. But what we didn't like was there was a lack of professionalism, I would say, with Airbnbs. No one seemed to think about hospitality. How do I wow the guest? The same way that I would like to think the Marcuses wake up every day and think about how do we wow the people that come into our hotel? I saw no indication that anyone that I stayed with within Airbnb was actually thinking that way. They were thinking much more about how do I get this person so they don't complain too much? Or how do I get them in and out of here with as little hassle as possible or as small a cost as possible? Beyond seeing no one that was doing a great job, it was very uneven. Some people, you know, the booking didn't work out and you all of a sudden you were looking for a place to stay at 5 p.m. In a city in Istanbul, in a city you don't know where to find a hotel with spotty internet. So yeah, that was my experience.
So what's the name of your new company?
So the new company is called Front Desk. We are a corporate lodging company, but a traditional corporate lodging company markets to large Fortune 500 companies for when their executives move around or they have a relocation. We do that, so we handle corporate lodging. But in addition, we serve the Airbnb market, VRBO, Booking.com. Corporate housing has generally only been practically available to executives or people within large organizations. Our hope is that the new tools that have emerged, Airbnb, VRBO, will allow us to open corporate housing to a much broader market.
We'll be interested in watching how that goes for you, Kyle. Thanks so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more about Kyle's story and suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com.
And be sure and listen to our other podcasts at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can also listen to other episodes from the series or suggest people to be featured in future segments at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then we'll learn what led the philosopher Henry David Thoreau to spend one night in Milwaukee. And we'll learn what he thought of his limited view of the city. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The philosopher Henry David Thoreau is best known today for writing he accomplished while he lived in a small cabin on Walden Pond outside Concord, Massachusetts. But just south of Milwaukee's Third Ward, a small marker outside a coffee shop denotes the place where Thoreau composed just a handful of lines.
Henry David Thoreau spent one night in Milwaukee on a somewhat unlikely journey toward the end of his life. It's barely a footnote in the history of a remarkable man, one that perhaps only the most ardent of Thoreau scholars have much considered.
Among them is Milwaukee area cardiologist James Matthew, who met us at that very spot on a sunny morning earlier this year to explain how Thoreau came to spend a night in Milwaukee. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you for having me.
So we are sitting at the corner of Pittsburgh and First in Walker's Point. We're just across the bridge to the Third Ward. The spot we're in is probably best known to people as a Colectivo coffee shop. But there's a little plaque outside, and we are sitting on the sidewalk, and the plaque has a picture of Henry David Thoreau. So what was the significance of the space we're in right now in the history of Henry David Thoreau?
You are absolutely right, Mitch. Most people know this place as a Colectivo coffee on First Street. But I know it as the place, at least the location, where Henry David Thoreau stayed for one night in 1861. Indeed, he made a note of the fact that he paid 75 cents a night for staying at the lake house, which was located at the current place where the Collective of Coffee is.
So it was essentially a little inn or a little hotel at that time.
It was a hotel that was conveniently located near the lake and near the train depot.
Well, and so what was Henry David Thoreau doing? What was Thoreau doing that he happened to be passing through Milwaukee in 1861?
That's an interesting story, and thank you for asking me. The background for Henry David Thoreau's journey to the West is described by himself in a letter that he wrote to Harrison Blake, who was from Worcester, Massachusetts, in May of 1861. And it goes like this. Dear Mr. Blake, I am feeling as invalid as the time when you and Brown saw me last time, perhaps even more invalid. And I'm afraid that winter might descend upon me before I get over my bronchitis. And accordingly, my doctor tells me that I should get out of this place and go west.
So essentially, he came west to try to get over his bronchitis and have a little adventure, maybe?
That's correct. He was suffering from, you know, what he described in this letter as bronchitis, which we now know as part of the condition called consumption, which is the old term for what we now call tuberculosis of the lungs. And it was thought that the weather in the West might be helpful to his health. But I must tell you that if one of the goals was to improve his health, it came to naught. Because by the time he got back to Concord, Massachusetts, his health was worse than when he set out on the journey to the West. In addition, I believe, as he once described, going west is like floating free. To go to east, he had to steer himself. So he always wanted to go to the west. And then he also was a botanist and a naturalist. So he never wanted to miss an opportunity to botanize. And one of the very interesting things that struck me by reading his journals or account of his journey to the West was that it was during this journey that he had his first opportunity to see crabapple.
It's amazing to think of someone as in touch with the natural world as Thoreau not having seen a crabapple tree until he was able to travel west.
Indeed, the crabapples grow best in western and southern portions in relation to the New England area. That's why he thought that the Glades in Philadelphia might be a very good place to go and see the crabapple.
Well, and so to get back to his stop in Milwaukee, that was on the way back from Minnesota, right?
Yeah, this is his journey. This is now famous as the last journey of Henry David Thoreau, and journey in quotations.
For someone who was suffering from tuberculosis, this must have been an incredibly arduous trip.
Yes, it was. And indeed, you know, towards the latter half of his journey, his health was deteriorating, and he could only sit by the fireside, and I'm sure he used some of this time to write his journals and prepare a detailed list of the plants that he found during his journey.
It is fortunate for us, though, that he was such a consistent and prolific writer.
The amount of work he did, not only in literature and philosophy and social reformation, but in botany and natural sciences in such a short time is nothing less than amazing. I might, you know, tell you how I got interested.
I think that would be terrific if, can you share with us the story of how you happened to become as interested in Thoreau as you are?
I'll be happy to indeed. This has been a frequent question to me, and I could play my standard response. I had known about Henry David Thoreau and read mostly quotes of Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, in newspaper editorial pages while I was growing up in India. And it was not until about 1983, when I was in the United States, that I came across a copy of Walden at a friend's house. And he was kind enough to offer me the copy, and I took advantage of it. I started reading Walden, and then I realized that what I had in my hands was a priceless book, which is timeless and spaceless in its value.
Do you think there's something especially important about reading Thoreau in this day and age?
As I alluded to earlier, any work of value, be it in literature or art, becomes a classic or has value only if it appeals to people in all time and in all regions.
So we don't have to read Walden as a product of its time. It's a timeless piece.
The location is local. The themes are contemporaneous to his time, but the importance of those principles are timeless and regionless. That is why it is still here today. Indeed, for about 50 years after Henry David Thoreau passed away, his writings were not recognized for what it was worth. It was only in the early 1900s, approximately 1905, that a foreigner sitting in a different country had to write to the press in the United States of America, bringing their attention to what your own philosophers have left behind, and why don't you pay attention to individuals like Henry David Thoreau rather than going after your current materialism. And I'm referring to a letter that Leo Tolstoy wrote to the American press in approximately 1905.
So when Thoreau spent the night in Milwaukee, he wouldn't necessarily have been well known at that point in a place like Milwaukee.
He would have been an obscure person in Milwaukee, I'm pretty sure. And he did not spend any substantial time in Milwaukee. Neither did he meet any person of importance here in Milwaukee. It was only like a one-night stayover on his way to the next major destination, which was Mackinac Islands. But in Minneapolis and St. Paul area, he did meet with a couple of individuals of importance.
Do you know the story of this plaque here?
In 2014, some local poets, headed by the then poet laureate of Milwaukee, Mr. Pienawas, and his friend and fellow poet Andler, along with some activists and fans of Henry David Thoreau from other parts of the country, I believe was part of their effort to identify and install plaques in stations where Henry David Thoreau had stopped by, installed this plaque at this location, which, as we mentioned, is the location where the lake house where Henry David Thoreau spent one night in 1861.
But to this point, we don't know the entirety of what he wrote about his time in Milwaukee.
I don't believe he wrote a lot about Milwaukee, but along the path from western Wisconsin to Milwaukee, he botanized and he made comments about the Mississippi River, he made comments about the Wisconsin River, but fortunately or unfortunately, he apparently did not make any such comments about either Milwaukee or the people in Milwaukee, except that he had to pay 75 cents to stay one night.
Well, and presumably after his time in Milwaukee, he might have had some things to say about Lake Michigan, because he took the steamer onto Mackinac from Milwaukee, right?
Oh, yes. He has given vivid descriptions of his sailing on the propeller Edith from Milwaukee to Mackinac Islands.
For someone who has studied Thoreau as much as you have, it must be gratifying, I guess, or it must be nice that he has this admittedly minor, but he does have some significance having been to Milwaukee.
Henry David Thoreau seldom ventured outside of New England. So the second location that he chose to go outside of New England included Milwaukee in his itinerary, and he never left any details to chances. He routed all these routes and stops in advance, and therefore Milwaukee was in his itinerary, and he did have opportunities to go to his destination without passing through Milwaukee. So I think it was a deliberate effort to go to the Midwest and include Milwaukee and Chicago in his itinerary. And of course, I'm now a Milwaukeean, so I'm sort of touched by the fact that I'm sitting right where the place where Henry David Thoreau stayed at least for one night in the summer of 1861. And I consider, you know, this soil sacred by the treading of Henry David Thoreau's feet.
Well, and you were saying that being where we are now, where Henry David Thoreau stayed for that one night in 1861, is a little bit like being on sacred ground. For you to be in Concord, Massachusetts has to be that feeling, you know, multiplied by 10.
Yes, indeed. That is the reason I keep going back to Concord, Massachusetts. I still remember the fragrance of the pine trees walking through the Main Street and Lexington Road that once spread the same scent that Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau enjoyed and talked about. I stayed at the Colonial Inn, which, according to history, was owned by the Thoreau family for a period of time. And according to legend, there is at least one room in the Colonial Inn which might have been occupied by Henry David Thoreau himself for a short period of time. I went to his birth house, which is on Virginia Street. I visited the Concord Library, where a number of Thoreau artifacts are preserved. And I also walked to the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, where Henry David Thoreau, along with many of the great literary and philosophical figures of mid-19th century of America, rest in peace. That was a very profound experience for me.
James Matthew, thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Thank you very much for your interest in Henry David Thoreau, and you are doing a great service to the community by broadcasting about Henry David Thoreau's life and legacy and his current relevance.
Dr. James Matthew is a Milwaukee-area cardiologist and an expert on the life and writing of Henry David Thoreau. You can see a photo of Matthew and the plaque marking Thoreau's one night here in Milwaukee at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we'll listen back to a song recorded recently in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. From a 19th century New England philosopher's trip to Milwaukee to a 21st century New England musician's trip here, Caitlin Canty is a Vermont native, but she now calls Nashville home.
She joined us in the studio not too long ago and offered up a few songs, including this one from her latest album, Motel Bouquet, a song called Scattershot.
Dark cloud like a gun, do you stay, do you run? Barrel pointed at the heart of the plains. Green bird on the wire, smoke before the fire, dry leaves coil and a rattling chain. Yellow edges of light, dust curls. Wind sighs like the moan of a faraway train. The rain came scattershot, taking aim with every drop. Doesn't care where it's been or where it's bound. It's coming scattershot, it wants another round. Hisses on an old TV. We packed up the car and didn't get far. River rising like you wouldn't believe it. Come down scattershot, taking aim with every drop. Doesn't care where you've been or where you're bound. You running scattershot. It wants another round. First it's filling up the wells, and it's rolling through the streets of this town, over the steps of the motel. Tore the sky from the clouds. It's rising to the rafters, climbing up the steeple, ringing all the bells.
Caitlin Canty recorded in Studio C1. The song was called Scattershot, and it also appears on her latest album called Motel Bouquet. And that is Monday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.